Good evening, brethren and sisters, and welcome to our Bible class for this week. Tonight we're to continue our series on 1 Corinthians, particularly tonight looking at the latter part of chapter 9 to the subject, I am made all things to all men, to be led by Brother Mark Bailey. So to begin with, we'll open with hymn number 360, followed by prayer. Before we have our study together this evening, we're going to have a current events summary by Brother Mark Pearce.
Brothers and sisters, excuse my rather nasally voice. What I'd like to do tonight, very briefly, in the 5 or so minutes that we've got, is try and raise the profile of the upcoming Middle East Peace Summit that's going to happen near Washington sometime this month. Just to the degree that that we might be aware of it and aware that there is some degree of excitement and anticipation that exists certainly on the part of the US and the Palestinians and also Israel in terms of perhaps the next phase of a peace initiative. Why do we think the summit's relevant? Why do we think that it's worthy of raising the profile of it? Well, our reading and understanding of Ezekiel chapter 38 tells us in the latter years in relation to the state of Israel that Gog will say in verse 11 of Ezekiel chapter 38, I'll go up to the land of unwalled villages, I'll go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates. And of course, we understand that this state of peace doesn't have to be in existence before the return of the Lord Jesus Christ, but what we can't rule out is at least the making of significant progress towards that end before our Lord's return. And so when we look at current events, such as the upcoming summit, we view with great interest the expectations of a fairly positive outcome. And this is even true in terms of the detail of the location that's been chosen, and that's the historically significant city of Annapolis. And quoting from the Washington Post, September 29, from the back page, I'll read, Annapolis, the 300-year-old city that hosted the Continental Congress and was one of the nation's early capitals, will add another chapter to its rich history by hosting a Middle East peace meeting late in November at the U.S. Naval Academy. U.S. officials said the Bush administration selected the academy in part because it provides a secure facility convenient to Washington. Also, they said unlike the presidential retreat at Camp David and the Y Plantation on Maryland's eastern shore, the academy is not associated with unsuccessful peace efforts during the Clinton administration. As news of the meeting spread, local historians drew parallels to the Annapolis of years past. It was in Annapolis that George Washington submitted his resignation to Congress as military leader in 1783. The nation's first war, the American Revolution, drew to a close in Annapolis. And the noted state archivist, Edward C. Pappenfuse, said, this was where Congress ratified the Treaty of Paris in 1784, which brought peace and established us as a nation among nations on the international scene. He said, so it's very fitting historically to be bringing international discussions of peace here again. And I guess we might think it's typically American to pump up anything that they're involved in, but it appears that this optimism is actually shared by the key players. As recently as Monday this week, and I'll be quoting from two articles from the BBC World News Online dated Sunday and Monday the 4th and 5th of November respectively, that Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas said he believes that there is a real possibility of achieving a peace deal with Israel. Progress was being made towards a US-sponsored Middle East peace conference expected later this month, Mr. Abbas said. Mr. Abbas was speaking after talks with US Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, who is in her 8th visit to the region this year, to prepare the ground for the planned peace conference in the US later this month. So 8 visits from a very busy woman, to me, indicates a fair level of commitment to a meaningful meeting. Mr. Abbas and Ms. Rice on Monday expressed hope that a peace deal could be reached before US President George W. Bush leaves office in January 2009. Mr. Abbas said that he'd received encouraging signs from both Israel and the US, but that he still expected negotiations to be tough. And in a quote from him, he says, "I agree with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert that there is a real possibility to achieve peace," unquote. Ms. Rice said she hoped that the planned conference would serve as a launching pad for Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, leading the way to a Palestinian state. After meetings on Sunday with Israeli officials, Ms. Rice said a two-state solution was needed more urgently than ever. Ms. Rice also urged Arab states to accept a peaceful and permanent home for Israel. And a quote from her reads, "Thus, if we don't act now to show the Palestinians a way forward, others will show them a way forward. Failure is simply not an option." And I guess she's saying that in the context of the fact that perhaps other world players may start to take hold of the reins and take it in a direction that wouldn't be all that desirable as far as the West goes. In relation to the date for the peace summit, expected in November, Condoleezza Rice said that she was not yet ready to set it. So there's no actual date yet for the summit. Obviously, they want to agree to certain things before they have the summit, but it's certainly still planned, at least for late November, and the location is set in concrete. So I think you'd have to agree that there's some pretty optimistic expectations about the summit, and I'm sure you'll join with me, and hopefully you're a little bit more aware, and together we're a little bit more aware about the very interesting summit that will be occurring, God willing, in late November. And of course, we're always aware that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men.
Thanks for that summary, Mark. We'll now prepare for our class on Corinthians together by reading together 1 Corinthians chapter 9, which Brother Graham Court will come forward and read for us. Reading with you 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Am I not an apostle? Am I not free? Have I not seen Jesus Christ our Lord? Are not ye my work in the Lord? If I be not an apostle unto others, yet doubtless I am to you, for the seal of mine apostleship are ye in the Lord. Mine answer to them that do examine me is this: have we not power to eat and to drink? Have we not power to lead about a sister, a wife, as well as other apostles, and as the brethren of the Lord, and Cephas? Or I only and Barnabas, have not we power to forbear working? Who goeth a warfare any time at his own charges? Who planteth a vineyard and eateth not of the fruit thereof? Or who feedeth a flock and eateth not of the milk of the flock? Say I these things as a man, or saith not the law the same also? For it is written in the law of Moses, thou shalt not muzzle the mouth of the ox that treadeth out the corn. Doth God take care for oxen? Or saith he it altogether for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt, this is written, that he that ploweth should plough in hope, and that he that thresheth in hope should be partaker of his hope. If we have sown unto you spiritual things, is it a great thing if we shall reap your carnal things? If others be partakers of this power over you, are not we rather? Nevertheless, we have not used this power, but suffer all things, lest we should hinder the gospel of Christ. Do ye not know that they which minister about holy things live of the things of the temple, and they which wait at the altar are partakers with the altar? Even so hath the Lord ordained that they which preach the gospel should live of the gospel. But I have used none of these things, neither have I written these things, that it should be so done unto me.
For it were better for me to die than that any man should make my glorying void. For though I preach the gospel, I have nothing to glory of, for necessity is laid upon me. Yea, woe is unto me if I preach not the gospel. For if I do this thing willingly, I have a reward. But if against my will, a dispensation of the gospel is committed unto me. What is my reward then? Verily that, when I preach the gospel, I may make the gospel of Christ without charge, that I abuse not my power in the gospel. For though I be free from all men, yet have I made myself servant unto all, that I might gain the more. And unto the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might gain the Jews. To them that are under the law, as under the law, that I might gain them that are under the law. To them that are without law, as without law, being not without law to God, but under the law to Christ, that I might gain them that are without law. To the weak became I as weak, that I might gain the weak. I made all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. And this I do for the gospel's sake, that I might be partaker thereof with you. Know ye not that they which run in a race run all, but one receiveth the prize? So run, that ye may obtain. And every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. I therefore so run, not as uncertainly. So fight I, not as one that beateth the air. But I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway.
Thanks, Graham. We'll now ask Brother Mark to come forward and lead us tonight to the topic, I am made all things to all men.
Thanks, Mark. I think I'm right, hopefully you are as well. Tonight we're looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 9, which as you remember, back to Uncle David's class, is dealing with this issue of the strong and the weak brethren. So just to again put us in structure so we can see where Paul is going with this argument. If we remember the scenario that Uncle David took us through in chapter 8, it was this, that suppose you with your knowledge of God should be observed eating meat in an idol's temple, are you not encouraging the man with a delicate conscience to do the same? And so here we have a situation with two classes of people. There was one, the strong, who had no problems partaking or eating in the idol's temple. And then we had, on the other side, we had the weak brethren who, because of their conscience, had a problem with eating in the idol's temple. And so we have the strong who had the knowledge versus the weak who had the conscience. And so we get the problem. And the problem was that surely you would not want your superior knowledge to bring spiritual disaster to a weaker brother for whom Christ died. And that was the issue that Paul was now faced with. And so the question to be pondered is, should we be guided by our superior knowledge or love? And that was the issue that Paul now had to deal with in chapter 8. And so Paul states his position. And in theory, he said to the Corinthian brethren that he totally agrees with the strong. However, in practice, he said that as far as Paul was concerned, if there was any possibility of meat injuring my brother, he said, I'll have none of it. He said, I might fear I do harm. And so that was the position that Paul took at the end of chapter 8. And so now when we come into chapter 9, which we looked at last time, we see that in verses 1 to 14, Paul went into to some length to detail his rights in relation to this. And as we saw last time, Paul really went on and used a number of these. And if you remember, there were six arguments that Paul put forward that says, look, I have rights too. And all the examples that Paul used to one, prove that he had rights, remembering, of course, that Paul had to prove that he was apostle. But all these examples that Paul used had some aspect of food or drink or eating related to them. And so in the first example of he gives, which is just common practice of everyday life of soldiers and farmers, shepherds, he said all those receive a reward for their toil, which we saw was the food that those things deservedly bring. And then he quoted from the law of Moses, and he to back up that even more, he said even the law of Moses supports that the cord-treading ox should be rewarded for the work that they have performed. And then if that wasn't enough, he went on to say that the ordinary gratitude should cause converts to support materially those who were able to get up and supply them with spiritual blessings. And then Paul went on with the argument and said, well, even apostles were more than spiritual teachers. They were their fathers in Christ, and as a result, they too should be supported. And then he continued further in chapter 9, and he said, even in the temple arrangements, priests were provided with the necessities of daily life. And then finally, he finishes on a supreme example, saying that Jesus Christ commanded that a worker is worthy of his food. And so Paul, in those first 14 verses, went into some length, detailing the rights that Paul had in this matter of requiring support from the brethren and sisters at Corinth. And he goes into to some length, as we looked at last time, maybe a little repetitive, but in the doing so, to get the point across that like as a strong brethren, Paul too had rights. However, when we come to verse 15, Paul says, but I have used none of these things, neither have I written these things, that it should be done so unto me. For it were better for me to die than that any man should make my glorying void. And so Paul's now going on in verses 15 to 18 to detail why Paul refuses to exercise his rights. Paul said, I had the right to be supported, but he didn't exercise it. And he says, more than that, I don't even intend to exercise it. And that's not the intent of the letter that I'm writing to you now. Paul says, yes, these other things, the soldiers, the farmers, etc., all had rights. They deserve support just as much as what Paul did. But Paul was not placing himself in the same league as these other people. And this certainly wasn't his motive for writing these things now. You know, to Paul, he was not embarrassed by the fact that he had to work for a living. In fact, Paul deliberately chose to give up his rights and was determined to work. As we read in Acts, these hands of mine provided me everything for my own needs and for my companions. In fact, all Paul wanted to do was explain to the Corinthians why he now has refused these things. And so we read at the end of verse 15, he says that I would rather die than have anyone make this boast of mine an empty one, as another translation translates. And to the Corinthians, they couldn't understand why. As far as they were concerned, the basis of any boasting that they were aware of was whether someone was a good speaker or not. And we know already that we looked at last time in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 5, that the Corinthians particularly honoured those who they considered to be super apostles, a class of apostles whom Paul didn't seem to fit. But the Corinthians particularly honoured those sorts of men. And Paul says at this time that he doesn't boast in such things. However, as the end of verse 15 indicates, Paul does feel he can boast about something, but it's not in relation to this fact. In fact, it's in relation to the fact that he can boast that he hasn't accepted any of the support or any of the rights that he has been entitled to, as he argued in the previous verses in that chapter. And so Paul now goes on in verse 16 and says, well, I'm refusing these rights, and now he's going to give four solid reasons to why he refuses them. And we see in verse 16, for though I preach the gospel, I have nothing to glory of, for necessity is laid upon me, yea, woe is unto me if I preach not the gospel. For if I do this thing willingly, I have a reward. But if against my will, a dispensation of the gospel is committed unto me. And so in those two verses, Paul is now going to tell them or give them four reasons as to why he's refused these rights. He says at the start of verse 16, for although I preach the gospel, I have nothing to glory of, for necessity is laid upon me. He says, I can't boast in the fact that I'm preaching the gospel because I have been compelled to teach. He says, I didn't ask to preach, it was compelled upon me. And we know if we turn back to Acts chapter 9, that Paul had no choice but to preach the gospel. And he says, as far as that is concerned, it's not a matter for me to boast about. He said, I'm compelled to do it. And so we read in Acts chapter 9 and verse 15, when the Lord tells Paul on the road to Damascus in verse 15, go thy way, for he is a chosen vessel unto me to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings, and the children of Israel. And so Paul was chosen for this task. He didn't ask for it. And in relation to that, Jeremiah was another person, Jeremiah chapter 20, verse 9, who had no choice but to be God's mouthpiece to the people at that time. And so that was the first reason that he gives. And then we see in that verse, he says, but woe unto me if I preach not the gospel. You know, Paul feared the consequences if he didn't preach it. In fact, Paul was cursing himself if he didn't fulfill it. He said, so it's a necessity to go, and it's a woe if I didn't, as someone expressed it. So he was sort of trapped. If he had to do it, but if he didn't, there were consequences. And as we know from another saying, a man who is forced to preach in order to save himself always makes a fervent preacher. And that certainly was the case with the Apostle Paul at this time. And so he goes on with the next reason in verse 17. He says that if I preach voluntarily, I have a reward. And so his argument is that, well, if I do this willingly, he said, that's my reward. He says, if I carried it out willingly, well, then he would have a good reason to boast about these things. But the thing is, he hadn't been doing it willingly. It wasn't a natural thing for Paul to do. And Paul says that he had done it against his will. a bit like the case of Jeremiah, as we mentioned, who didn't want to, but as a result, he had to through God's influence. And then we go and see the fourth reason at the end of verse 14 as to why he refused these rites. He says, but if it, and reading from the J.B. Phillips translation, it says, but if it is no choice of mine but a sacred responsibility put upon me, what can I expect in the way of a reward? And the word dispensation that's mentioned there in verse 17 is a word for stewardship. And so Paul was given the responsibility, he was entrusted to preach the gospel. If we turn back to Luke chapter 16 and verse 2, this is another occurrence where this same word is used to show that it was his stewardship. And as a result, he had a responsibility entrusted to him to preach the gospel. And so here we find in Luke chapter 16 and verse 1 that there was a certain rich man which had a steward, and the same was accused unto him that he had wasted his goods. And he called him and said unto him, how is it that I hear this of thee? Give an account of thy stewardship, for thou mayest be no longer steward. Then the steward said within himself, what shall I do? For my Lord taketh away from me the stewardship. I cannot dig to beg, I am ashamed. I am resolved what to do, that when I am put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their houses. And so the word for stewardship that occurs in those verses is exactly the same. And as a steward in this parable had a responsibility to the rich man, so it was that the Apostle Paul had a responsibility entrusted to him to preach the gospel. And therefore, Paul didn't go out there willingly, as we've said, but he's done it because that was his duty to do, as we as is turned in Luke 17, verse 10. The Apostle Paul knew that there were consequences if he had failed. And so just looking at the reasons then, in summary, as to why Paul refused the rites, he says to them that he had no alternative, that woe unto me if I don't preach the gospel. He says if I had done it willingly, I would have a cause to boast, but I am not. And then there was this issue of responsibility. He said, I've been put in a charge of a house. And so they were the four reasons he gives as to why he refuses to take up his rights. And so when we come back to 1 Corinthians chapter 9, Paul now goes on in verse 18 and says, well, what is my reward then? He says, if it's the expectation that I should receive support from you for everything that I have done. And we read earlier that he acknowledged at the end of verse 15 that there was something that he could boast about. Obviously, the ticking in the minds of the Corinthians was, well, what was this boasting? What was this reward that Paul was able to get for refusing this? And so we see it here in verse 16. He says, again reading from J.B. Phillips, I can make it absolutely free of charge, this is the gospel, and need not claim what is rightfully due as a preacher. And to the Apostle Paul, that was the reward that he was able to glory in the fact that he could go out there and preach the gospel, and he could do it absolutely free of charge. and need not claim what is rightfully due as a preacher. That was the reward of the Apostle Paul, that he could do it free of charge. And this was a voluntary decision that Paul had made. And so Paul was delighted in being able to accomplish this and do this. It was the one thing that Paul did, and he was happy for having made that decision. And so it was that Paul was more than happy to work for a living and to support his companions. And it's sort of the attitude that we contrast back in the Old Testament to the prophet Balaam, who, when we read in Numbers chapter 22, it appears that Balaam only carries out his preaching or his proclaiming for the money. And this is definitely not what Paul was doing as he set about going out preaching the gospel. And so we have a bit of time for a moment just to reflect and to maybe place ourselves in the shoes of the Apostle Paul, thinking about the fact that we as Christadelphians have no alternative but to preach the gospel. And we know from various passages within the Bible that if we shirk our responsibilities in this regard, then we'll have to give an account at the judgment seat of Christ. I guess like the Apostle Paul, and maybe for many of us, you know, it's sometimes hard to go out and preach the gospel, and it's sometimes we're in situations where it's sort of against our will to actually do so when we're presented with opportunities. But we know we need to do it, and sometimes we force ourselves to preach, even though it's maybe a situation that's something naturally that we don't do. Like the Apostle Paul, we too are given a responsibility, and it's for up to us to go out and make sure that we're a part of that preaching work that happens here at the Ecclesia of Brighton. Whether it's just supporting the lectures on a Sunday or the seminar work on a Tuesday, or even if it's the work of distributing the leaflets when that arises, or just the fact of noticing someone wherever we happen to be in our walk of life. And obviously, in relation to these things, there's certainly situations where we can go about preaching. It's certainly not a or not something that we should go out and boast about. How many people have come in because of our preaching efforts? How many that we can get to our seminars as a result of the work of Ecclesia? And so they're all lessons that we can take from Paul's reasons as to why he refuses the support of the brethren. Because to Paul, preaching the gospel was something that he could do free of charge, and he wanted to keep it as that. So now what Paul goes on to do from verse 19, is he now goes on to, in verses 19 to 23, to point out why he serves all men. And this is a message that he really wants to get across to the brethren at this time in Corinth. And so we read in verse 19, "For though I be free from all men, yet have I made myself servant unto all, that I might gain the more." And so Paul acknowledges here in verse 19 that he is a servant. We see that there in that verse. "For being free, for though I am no man's slave," he says, yet have I made a slave to everyone. And that was the attitude of the Apostle Paul. He knew he was a servant of Christ, and he was a servant of Christ by choice. Paul had made himself a slave in this matter. And we see there that as a consequence of being a slave to Christ, he now had enslaved himself to everyone that it was round about. And he chose to be a slave in that regard. Paul knew that there'll be loss of financial support, but as far as Paul was concerned in refusing that support, Paul knew that the spiritual gain more than compensated for that. And as far as Paul was concerned, there was no way he was going to give that right up, that right to preach the truth freely. We know as far as the Apostle Paul was concerned, the gospel dominated his life. And so we see that Paul now lays aside these rites in order to win as many people as possible to the truth. And we see there that the word gain there towards the end of the verse is to gain one to the faith in Christ. In fact, the same word is used in Matthew chapter 16, verse 24 to 27, in that well-known phrase, "What will man gain by winning the whole world at the cost of true self?" And that's certainly something that we too need to think about in our lives. What will we gain by winning the whole world at the cost of our true selves? And so the Apostle Paul now goes on in verse 20 and he says, "Unto the Jews I became a Jew, that I might gain the Jews, to them that are under the law as under the law, that I might gain them that are under the law, to them that are without the law as without law, being not without law to God but under the law to Christ, that I might gain them that are without the law." And so as a result of Paul explaining that because he was a servant to Christ, the outworking of that was he was now a servant to everyone. And as a demonstration of how he was a servant to everyone, he now gives four groups of people in verses 21 to 24. Verse 20 to 21. He outlines here four groups of people as examples of how he was able to serve everyone. And so we see in verse 20 then, he says, "To them that are without law, as without law, being not without law to God, but under the law of Christ." Verse 20. "And unto the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might gain the Jews." What Paul seems to be indicating here in these verses is that he varies his personal behaviour depending upon his audience. And he does so to ensure that he's in a better position to serve others by honouring their preferences and practices. I guess to some of us that may send off alarm bells, that the fact that we need to alter our behaviour in order to fit in with the group that we're trying to win to Christ. But as we'll see here, that Paul did so, but in a way that didn't compromise his true position before God. And so the first group that we see there in verse 1 is that obviously under the Jews I became a Jew. And the Jews who were under the law, we see that the Apostle Paul took on their law-observant patterns of living only if they were unimportant although he acknowledges that he was not under their law. Let's look at a couple of examples to demonstrate this. Come across to Acts chapter 16 and verse 3. In Acts chapter 16, verse 3, it's the incident of the circumcision of Timothy, an example how he took on the law patterns or law observant patterns of the Jews if they were unimportant. And so we see there in verse 3 the example of Paul, who would have to go forth with him and took the circumcised him, because of the Jews which were in those quarters, for they knew all that his father was a Greek, and obviously in relation to Timothy. We know in Acts chapter 21, verse 23, there's the example of the purification of Paul. And in Galatians chapter 2 and verse 3, we have the opposite example, a situation where Paul would have compromised his position had he taken on the law of the Jews, but in Galatians chapter 2 and verse 3, he doesn't do that. So that's an example then of how Paul was unto a Jew, he became a Jew. So that was one group of people who Paul saw he was able to serve. And so at the end, or the second part of verse 20, he lists the second group of people to whom he could relate to. He said, to them that are under the law, I became as under the law that I might gain them that are under it. And I believe that this reference is actually to the Jewish proselytes. He says, to the Jewish proselytes, I became as a Jewish proselyte. And Paul conformed to their practices, so he was a better position to be able to approach them. And however, we see that to those who are under the law, as again another translation puts, he says, I put myself in the position of being under it, although in fact I stand free of it. And so what he says, although I'm going to take on some of these things, he knew that it didn't really have that effect on him. And so as a Jewish proselyte, he became as a Jewish proselyte. And now he goes on to give another class of people in verse 22, in verse 21. He says, to them that are without the law, as without the law, being not without the law to God, but under the law to Christ, that I might gain them that are without the law. And so this third group of people are obviously the Gentiles. And so to the Gentiles, Paul says, I became a Gentile. And as far as the Gentiles were concerned, they weren't bound by any laws. And so he met them on their own ground. And just as an example of how he did that, if we come across to Acts chapter 17, we see in verse 28 that one of the ways in which Paul was able to become a Gentile was in verse 28 of Acts 17, where we read, for in him we live and move and have our being, as certain also of your poets have said, for we are also his offspring. So as Paul was preaching to the Gentiles at this time, he quotes their poets, someone they are familiar with, as a way in which he becomes a Gentile, as an example. And so he lived as they did. However, verse Corinthians chapter 9 does put in the proviso that it doesn't mean that, like the Gentile, he's free to do anything. He does put the proviso in that though he was free from God's law, he was bound by the laws of Christ. And so as the Gentiles who weren't bound by the laws of God mean they could do anything, to the apostle says, I'm still bound by the laws of Christ. And so having now demonstrated to these three groups of people, in verse 22, Paul now comes to the crux of his argument at this time. He says that by rights, I should be supported by you. However, he says, I refuse to take up those rights. He says, I refuse to do that. And we've already seen that there were four reasons why he did that. He said, and the reason was that he wanted to be able to preach the truth voluntarily. And that was his reason for doing that. And though he became bound to Christ, he was actually the servant to everyone. And as a result of that, he says, well, as a Jew, I become a Jew. He says, as a Jewish proselyte, I become a Jewish proselyte. He says, as a Gentile, I become as a Gentile. And to really hit the point home, he says in verse 22, to the weak, I became as weak, that I might gain the weak. I made all things to all men, that I might be all means save some. And so this is the climax of Paul's argument. He says, to the weak, I become as the weak, or I became a weak man. And this was his appeal to the strong brethren in the ecclesia at this time. He appeals to them, if I can do that, strong brethren, can't you do the same, is his appeal. Paul says, I'm all things to everyone, whether it was a Jew, a Jewish proselyte, a Gentile, or even the weak. He says, I'm appealing to you, strong brethren. All I'm asking you to do is to be one thing to the weak here. That's all I'm asking you to do. You, strong brethren, to be weak as the weak. And so he goes on in verse 23 and says, and this I do for the gospel's sake, that I might be partaker thereof with you. This is the reason why Paul was a slave to everyone. In verse 23, he said, I did it for the sake of the gospel. The gospel which I voluntarily go out and preach to everyone. He says, I want to play my part. And so Paul devoted himself without reserve to the spiritual welfare of others to ensure his own participation in the gospel. And this was the motive of Paul. Paul does it because he just doesn't want to help these brethren get into the kingdom. It's more than that. Paul also wants to share it with them. If we come to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, we have another example in the writings of Paul where he expresses this same idea. First Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 19, where he says, for what is our hope or joy or crown of rejoicing? Are not even ye in the presence of our Lord Jesus Christ at his coming? For ye are our glory and joy. This was the motive of Paul. And so this was his appeal. He doesn't want to just help them get into the kingdom. He also wants to be there and to be able to share it with them as well, with these brethren that he's helped along the way. And what an amazing example that is to us in our lives. Sure, it's we may do things on a day-to-day basis to help people, just maybe out of the kindness of our heart, But to have this attitude of helping these people because we want to be there at the end and share that same joy with them is an amazing motive to have in our lives, and something that we could take away from tonight, this example of the Apostle Paul. And from verse 23 there, it's quite possible then that in this matter of the strong and weak brethren, the fact that Paul's brought this argument to a head and appealed to the strong brethren to be as the weak, that that could be the end of Paul's argument. But now we see in verses 24 to 27 that Paul actually now goes on to take this argument just a little more further. And in this section, verses 24 to 27, Paul now goes on to deal with this issue of self-control. If we're going to be weak as the weak brother, then in our lives we need to develop this attitude of self-control. And so, as a customary to Paul, or he has certainly a lot of experience and uses a lot of these types of examples in his writings, we have the example of the athlete and the boxer. And so we read in verse 24, he says, "Know ye not that they which run in a race, that run in a race run all, but one receiveth the prize? So run that ye may obtain." And so Paul now goes in these verses to give a warning to the strong brethren at this time. He says, "You strong brethren," these weak brethren here actually have something to teach you. There's something to be admired about these weak brethren that they can teach you. And he says there that a believer must constantly run to the best of his ability. And so as he goes on here, he says, "Oh, by the way, the Corinthians, you remember how on the racing track every competitor runs but only one wins the prize." And as you probably are all already aware, that Corinth was the centre for the Isthmian Games. Now, these games were after the Olympic Games, these Isthmian Games, spelled probably nothing like I just said, but anyway, Isthmian, were the next best thing after the Olympic Games. If you couldn't get to the Games, then these were the ones to be at, which also happened, or these ones happened every 2 years. And Paul says that the fact that these games were held in Corinth, these Corinthians would have seen these athletes going around the place as they trained for this event. And so thinking about the attitudes of the Corinthians and obviously noticing these athletes all around the place as the Corinthians would have done from time to time, Paul senses that the Corinthians had somehow become spiritual flabby, which I think is a good expression to use. And sometimes it would be great to get the reward without the hard work. And Paul seems to think that these Corinthians were in their comfort zone where they were not really ready to train. And so Paul now goes about to give them a challenge. He says, just don't enter and go through the motions of running the race for Christ. He says, what you need to do is you need to go out and you need to run to win. And Paul is stating that if we want to win the prize, then we need to have a life of discipline. We need to have a life that's disciplined. He says to them, it wasn't good enough just to be in the race. He was telling them, you must run to win. And so now in the rest of these verses, Paul now goes on to map out for them a game plan. He says, if you want to run to win, then I'm going to give you four things that are a great game plan and are going to help you to be able to achieve that. And so we see in the next four verses, all bracketed under discipline, this is Paul's game plan that he's going to give the Corinthian brethren in order that they can run to win. He says, in order to achieve that, you need an incentive. You need self-control. You need direction. And you need denial. And we're going to see that now develop in verses 24 to 27. And so we see there in verse 24, know ye not that they which run in a race run all, but one receiveth the prize, so run that ye may obtain. And every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it to attain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. I therefore so run, not as uncertainly, so fight I, not as one that beateth the air, but I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be cast away. Now that word striveth there in verse 25 literally means to struggle, to complete for the prize. In fact, the same word, if we come back to Luke chapter 13 and verse 24, is used in this context. This idea of struggling, this idea of competing the prize for the prize. Now, when I pictured this, the idea I have is, as I had at the train station this morning, the train pulls up, and there's about 20 of you trying to get through the door at once. And this is the struggle or the way in which that we're competing for the prize. And this is the context in which it's used in Luke 13 and verse 24. Strive to enter in at the straight gate. For many, I say unto you, will seek to enter therein and shall not be able to. And so that's the idea of the struggle that's put forward here, to make every effort to get through that narrow door. And the same word is also used in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 10, and in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 7. Probably familiar verses where Paul uses this example of, the good fight. I fought a good fight. Coming back then to 1 Corinthians chapter 9, Paul says, every man striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things. And obviously this word temperate figuratively means this rigid self-control that's practiced by athletes with a view to gaining the prize. And so this is Paul's second point here in verse 25. However, is this idea of self-control. But obviously in verse 24 was this idea of incentive, which I accidentally skipped over. This idea of where he says here that that if you run, all but one receiveth the prize, so run that ye may attain. That was the focus that the Corinthians needed to have. That was the incentive, to run with your minds fixed on the prize. And Paul now says that if you have that as your goal, another thing that you need to do is have this self-control that we've just read about now in verse 25. We know that all athletes that competed in games need this self-control. They need to go through this strict training. They need to discipline their bodies in order to make themselves as fit as possible. And the history books tell us that in preparations for these games that are second to the Olympics that are held in Corinth, that there was a 10-month training program that athletes had to endure, where they were able to self-deny a lot of things, as most of the elite athletes do today, in order to make them as fit and as ready as possible to run the race. And as we contemplate that for a moment, it certainly makes us think about what are we doing to prepare for our victory? To think about how disciplined we are in our lives. And maybe as a reflection upon that, we may think about that, are our diets a true reflection of how disciplined we are to winning the race? Now, how disciplined, how much self-control do we have? As we read in 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 7, we need to discipline ourselves for the purpose of godliness. And so in discipline, we're training to become stronger, to become fitter, that we might be prepared for this race. So in relation to our training regime, what is it that gives us the strength in our lives? What is us that trains us for these things? What sorts of things are we doing? What's our training program like in order to prepare us for this race? Are we working out regularly in God's word and prayer? And why do we need to do these things? In order to win a prize. In the case of the athletes, it's just the laurel wreath that withers and dies. And we know that in Corinth, this is what they did. And we know that this training resume that they go through in order to win this wreath that withers and dies, we know in addition to that, that history reveals that in addition to that wreath, they also received lifetime exemptions from paying taxes, from serving in the military, for tuition fees, for education, and they even had statues of themselves that were placed along the road that led to the site of the games. So as far as this training was concerned, it was extremely important to get the rewards should they win the race. And so for them, this idea of self-discipline was crucial in order for them to get that laurel wreath. And just as that training was crucial to them, so it is in our lives, in order that we may be in better position to run our race, that we may be in a better position to be more committed to these things, that we be more dedicated to run our race in order to gain a crown that is incorruptible. As we read in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 8, as Paul also alludes to. And so in addition to having that incentive, to having self-control, Paul now goes on to the third point of his big game plan, is that this idea that they need to have direction in their lives. And so he says, I therefore so run, not as uncertainly, so fight I, not as one that beateth the air. And so we see that they need direction. They need to run with that clear goal before me. They need to run without swerving. And we obviously have the example that Paul alludes to of Jesus Christ in Hebrews chapter 12 and verses 1 to 4. But I think the examples of words in Proverbs 4 help us provide for us in verses 25 and 27 this fixation that we need to have, where we read in verse 25, let thine eyes look right on, let our eyelids look straight before thee, turn not to the right hand nor to the left. And that's the singleness of the fix that we need to have in our lives, of the goal set before us, that we can run without swerving as we focus on that goal. You know, if we don't, I have a daughter that I remember her very first race that had eight lanes. She started in the left, but she won, but she ended up in the right-hand lane because she lost that focus of looking to the people to her right. And as she ran across, keep looking to the people to the right, she missed the mark and would have saved herself a little effort. And that's what Paul is saying here. We need to be fixed on the direction in life. And he goes on to say that I fight not as one that beateth the air. He says, I'm no shadow boxer. I really fight. And what Paul's meaning by that is the efforts he puts in are not aimless. Paul doesn't waste his time that he has, nor does Paul waste his effort or opportunities. He acts with a purpose. Every punch that he makes hits the mark. And so as we'll sing in our final hymn, that we fight the good fight with all our might. But in reality, brethren and sisters, is that what we're really doing? Are we really fighting the good fight with all our might? And so Paul concludes this chapter by looking at this last game plan, this one of denial in verse 4. They needed to deny themselves. And so we read here that Paul says, I keep under my body. Now, this expression that I keep under my body literally means to hit under the eye, to beat black and blue, to smite so as to cause bruises and livid spots. And so what Paul is saying here is that he's subjecting himself, or he's bringing himself to bondage. And Romans chapter 7 is a good example of the fighting that Paul's enduring at this time. He says, don't let your body tell your mind what to do. Let your mind tell your body what to do. And so this is what Paul does. He fights his body in order to deny himself. And if hitting himself under the eye to beat it black and blue indicates the sort of pressures and the lengths Paul went to in order to deny himself of those things, and shows immense discipline that the Apostle Paul has in his life. And Paul says and acknowledges that, look, if I don't do this, then this is what will happen to me. If I indulge in things that weaken me, he says, I won't be fit to run the race. And so we need to think about what comforts in life are we giving up for the sake of the truth? He says, if the Corinthians are not training on a daily basis, that if they're not disciplining themselves, if they have no incentive, if they don't have restrictions, if they're not doing it with directions, then he's saying that when it comes to run the race, that their body won't obey their demands. An athlete can't operate just by eating everything and doing nothing. He has to be ready to follow the training rules. And if we're able to apply this game plan of incentive, self-control, direction and denial, if we're regimented in our training and our training practices, then when we're in situations like Joseph was in Genesis chapter 39 and verse 12, then we're fit enough to actually flee as Potiphar did in that example. They're the sort of situations that we train for, to flee from those things as we run the race toward the kingdom. And so he says there in those verses, ending in the verse 27, lest that by any means when I have preached to others, I myself should be cast away. And the word preach there means to be a herald. And the word cast away signifies to not standing the test. It means rejected. It means disqualification. And it's the same principle as found in Proverbs chapter 25 and verse 4. As far as the dross being tossed away after the silver has been purified. And what what was one of the characteristics of these games that were held in Corinth is, as we know, there was a 10-month training period which they had to go through. And during those 10 months, they had to certify that they were faithful in their training that they did during that period. And the reason was, is before the race actually commenced at the time preceding it, all the contestants were led out into the arena. And as they were led out, there was someone that herald, the master of ceremonies, I guess, and he shouted in a loud voice as these athletes came out one by one. He shouted out in a loud voice to any of the spectators that were there if there was anything that they could accuse these athletes of, any crime, wickedness, etc., that they had done during that training period. And if any of those athletes were accused of anything, they were disqualified right away. So Paul says that breaking rules means disqualification. And they were disqualified because of lack of self-control or discipline. And so as we read in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 5, no athlete can win a prize unless he keeps the rules. And that was how Paul finishes chapter 9 as he deals with this issue of eating of the strong and weak brethren in this matter of eating meat offered unto idols. And so as we look at this, as Paul says in as he started that last section, that to you strong brethren, become weak as they are weak. He says that as the weak show restraint, they are in a. That's what you need to do. And as we reflect upon these things, we almost get a complete turnaround of the weak brethren now becoming the strong, and the strong becoming the weak. Because the weak could show this restraint, and as a result of Paul's game plan that he had set in motion, of this idea of discipline, of incentive, self-control, direction and denial, as far as Paul was concerned. And we need to apply those same things in our life. And as we looked at last time, this idea of we need to put up this spiritual firewall in our lives. So things that we need to think about are, can I offer thanks beforehand and thus commit what I'm doing to God? Will it be edifying? Will it cause my brother or sister to stumble? Can I do it to the glory of God? Can I share it with my brethren and sisters as an act of fellowship? Would I do it if the Lord Jesus was with me? And so as Paul was a servant to Christ, he became a servant to all. And so may in our lives we are able to show this same example as the Apostle Paul did at this time. Thanks.